I will be presenting some findings on a project that we did looking at spinal cord injury research in the news media. And first, I'd just like to acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Thilo Kroll, who's here today as well. And we'll get this out of the way. I have no relationships to disclose. So just to set the stage a little bit, I think those of us in the spinal cord injury research community and in the greater disability world often wonder whether the knowledge that our research produces successfully is translated to the general population who do not sit around reading peer-reviewed journals. So I think most of the general population relies on the news media to form any type of opinion on spinal cord injury research. And so the news media plays a very critical role at shaping public opinion. And this may be something of interest to researchers to consider. So our objectives in this study were to perform a content and text analysis on select US newsprint between 1998 and 2007. So to identify potential trends in reporting frequency of spinal cord injury research, and to identify potential trends in the type of research reported. Particularly, our interest was in research aimed at rehabilitating spinal cord injury versus research seeking to cure spinal cord injury. And our second objective was then to juxtapose any reporting trends with the timeline of news events potentially associated with these identified shifts. So what we did was a LexisNexis search. We selected five major US newspapers based on circulation rates, but then limited to what was available within LexisNexis. Our 10-year time frame allows us to identify trends. And we used keywords spinal cord or spinal injury and research. The articles were then extracted, read, analyzed, and here presented. So what these keywords produced was 993 articles. And not surprisingly, most of them, 590, were ineligible. No association between those keywords. We kept a rather wide net. And then 48 articles we identify as secondary, meaning they weren't primarily about spinal cord injury research, but they mentioned it at least tangentially, so we felt it appropriate to identify them. So our interest here in our analysis was on the 355 articles that were primarily about spinal cord injury research. We then divided them into whether or not the type of research was cure-focused or rehab-focused. The large majority, 286 of these articles, were about research aimed at curing SCI, and only 37 aimed at rehabilitating SCI. And the 32 that are marked unclear were about SCI research, but it just wasn't clear what kind of research. So we take a little bit of a closer look at these two groups so we understand what the cure research and rehab research is. The cure research overwhelmingly was looking at stem cell research. And then the remaining regenerative medicine therapeutic cloning certainly overlap with stem cell research. But the rehab-focused articles, their subtopics were more varied. 13 were aimed at physical rehabilitation research, such as electrical stimulation and the use of exercise to enhance function. 12 were on biotechnology with research projects using robotics or supported treadmill training. 7 were in the neuroscience area using brain implants to enhance function. And then the remaining 5 in the general health and well-being category, such as researching the prevention of secondary conditions or enhancing independence. So I'll bring your attention to that bottom row. There's our 355 articles. And just to give you some more information about these articles, the median word count was 957 words, but you'll notice the rehab articles, although smaller in number, had a larger word count than the cure-focused articles. 53% of all articles found their way in Section A of these papers, Section A being the main section of each of these newspapers. But the median start page for the cure-focused articles was page 6, and the median start page for the rehab articles was page 3. And then of the 41 articles that found their way to the front page, proportionally, the rehab articles, again, were more likely to find their way on the front page than the cure-focused articles. Then we looked at the context of the research. How is the research being regarded in these articles? And we identify 5 categories, or 5 different ways the research was presented. And if you first look at the cure research row, you'll see the majority, or at least a larger percent, 47%, were of funding, cure research, followed by the promotion of cure-focused research, 21%. And then smaller percentages for the specific findings, ongoing conduction, and then very few on the application of this type of research. In contrast, the rehab articles, 70% were on the conduction of ongoing rehabilitation research projects, and very, very few on funding or promotion issues, and then larger percentages on findings, and compared to cure research, a larger percent on the application of such research. So these two different types of SCI research are being presented in different ways in the media. So then we thought it would be interesting to see whose work out there is being cited most frequently in these articles. For cure research, much of what's being referenced is being referenced from international works, such as in South Korea or in Sweden, and then the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis and work done at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical Center was also most often cited. For rehab research articles, when specific studies were being referenced, these four institutions were most likely to be those institutions: Brown University, Duke University, Case Western, and University Hospitals of Cleveland. Then we were interested to see who's being cited the most, not necessarily individuals, but maybe individuals at certain institutions, maybe who has the best PR group, who's being most represented out there in the media. So not surprisingly, I mean, Christopher Reeve and his foundation came in first. Nancy Reagan, who's a big advocate of stem cell research, her name came up second. Someone at Johns Hopkins Universities. We didn't necessarily keep track of the individuals, but the institution itself, followed by the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis, Harvard Medical School, Advanced Cell Technology, University of Wisconsin, Washington U in St. Louis, Rutgers, Mark Buonaconte, who was the football player injured in 85, University of Pittsburgh, and Kessler Institute. We also extracted news events that were referenced in the articles unrelated to the spinal cord injury to see what other events in the news were being incorporated into these articles. 55% of all of the articles we found referenced President Bush's 2001 restriction on funding for stem cell research. So this was the most commonly cited news event, followed by Christopher Reeve's injury and then his death. The scientist in South Korea who extracted stem cells from a cloned human embryo, that came in fourth. The presidential election of 2004, as well as the ballot measure here in California to fund stem cell research. And then, of course, that scientist in South Korea was eventually the charges of fraud. That came in seven. Mark Buonaconte's injury. University of Wisconsin scientist isolates the first embryonic stem cell in 98. And New Jersey's enactment of funding for stem cell research came in 10th. So then we took all of these articles and tried to identify some kind of trend over time. So what this graph shows you is the 10 years in which articles were extracted, broken up by quarters. And you can see there's a consistent up and down kind of a flow of frequency of publications with two clear spikes. That first spike is in the fall of 2001, and the second one in the fall-winter of 2004. So we went back and looked for news events that were most commonly cited in these articles to see if any of these news events happened around these particular times, and perhaps there's an association. And before that first spike was August 2001, when President Bush announced that restriction on federal funding for stem cell research, and that first spike occurred in the months following that. And right around the time of that second spike was Christopher Reeve's death in October 04 and the presidential election in 04, which again also included Proposition 71 in California to fund stem cell research. Then we decided we would look at the same timeline but break apart cure-focused articles versus rehab-focused articles. And the colors aren't quite distinct. So there's a lighter colored or kind of a reddish fuchsia color that represents the frequency of publication for cure-focused research. And there's two spikes there, and not surprisingly, they follow the same two spikes in that previous slide. So what's of more interest is what should be blue, that darker colored line, which represents the frequency of rehab research publications, which doesn't necessarily follow the same trend. And in fact, there's several spikes in that blue line that occur when the cure research is at a very low point in between 2002, 2003, 2004. And incidentally, the rehab articles rarely ever cited any other kind of news event that was happening in the world. Not to suggest there were no associations, but they weren't being cited in the articles. So some general conclusions. Research focused on curing spinal cord injury received significantly more attention by print media than research focused on rehabilitating spinal cord injury. More often, cure research is referenced in the context of funding and promotion, while rehabilitation research is referenced in the context of ongoing work or the application of specific findings. So they're being presented in two different types of ways. While there are more cure-focused articles, the rehabilitation articles were more likely to be on the front page, more likely to start on an earlier page, and had a longer median word count than the cure-focused articles. And last, political news events appear associated with spikes in cure-focused research coverage. There didn't, again, appear to be any association of news events with the rehab research articles. And there may have been, but they just weren't being noted in those particular articles. The cure-focused articles, again, were just more sensitive, seemingly more sensitive to political events. So we walk away with some implications or some general questions to consider is, does media reporting and specific topical representation in the media influence funding streams? Certainly the media has a role at shaping public opinion, so it seems plausible that that could translate or not translate into certain funding dollars. What are the reasons for a different focus in reporting? And I think just from this small project, advocacy of one type of research over another plays a strong role. So certainly while Christopher Reeve advocated for all types of spinal cord injury research, he was regarded more so in the public, I think, for his advocacy of stem cell research. And what kind of changes and trends might we expect going forward? Certainly with a new administration and new Congress, we can expect the stem cell debate to return, and potentially more funding, if that occurs, is released, then we could see another spike in that kind of publication. And just some limitations that are obviously important to note here. Is that we selected the newspapers and the media market. I think more people now turn to online media and cable news, certainly for their information. And this was limited just to newspapers. And I think it would be interesting to explore the same type of content media analysis in those types of media, and also the selected news events that we extracted to identify. Thank you.
I want to thank all of the speakers for their organization, the richness of their content, the soundness of their methodology, and your brevity and ability to just stay within the time frame. So thank you very much. This does leave us some time for questions. If you would approach the microphone, please. Tell us who you are and to whom you are directing the question.
My name is Mike Fox. I'm with the University of Kansas. And I was really taken by Grace's, Josh's, and Amanda's research in informing us here of some severe shortcomings in federal policy with respect to people with disabilities. Obviously, I'm familiar with Amanda's work, having worked with her on it, but you know, Joshua and Grace in particular, this really seems to show a degree of discrimination in federal policy that frequently goes unrecognized. I guess my question to all three of you is, how do you amplify these findings in ways that actually get to policymakers to help change federal policy so that it's written in the first place without the unintended consequences of discriminating against people with disabilities?
Who'd like to take that first?
I think the phrase that you said really resonated, unintended consequence. And the only, perhaps, idea that I have is to really, when legislators are working on writing policy or revising policy, that they consult extensively with community groups and community members. Otherwise, they're not going to get the individualized stories that will help to inform those policies. I mean, I think like the work that I've done and the work that Josh has done, it's all quantitative and it's very useful in perhaps pointing directions as to, you know, places of concern, but it's really the stories of individual members and people in the community who can sort of say, you know, this legislation will address all of these issues, but for my constituency or for my group, it's going to be very limited in these ways. So that would be my suggestion.
I think really with I'm adding with what Grace had mentioned, even as we were going through a lot of this research, I think some of it came back of, okay, now we have some information, but there's still a lot that we don't have the answers for. And I think we had some data on the differences between different chronic health conditions and their prevalence within each population, and that's certainly one item that could have a contributing factor within some of the cost side that we were looking at, but we don't have all of that information yet. And while I think we're slowly moving in the right direction in order to balance out some of this inequity between the groups, we also need to not really rush into this and try solving problems that we don't have all the answers for yet. Certainly something that we hope for in order to balance it out, but not at the sake of rushing into this and possibly creating more problems than we may solve.
I would say that really we typically like to approach it from a top-down and bottom-up approach at the same, both at the same time. So to take the information to our state legislators and policymakers at the agencies and the information that we're finding so that we can let them know, you know, they don't always have the numbers. They might have more anecdotal information, so have to give them more quantitative means for their arguments helps. And then, at least at the state level, but also just to go to the independent living centers in our case, and to consumers, Medicaid consumers and Medicare consumers, and have them spread the word as well, and so that we're working it from the top and the bottom at the same time.
Colette, Matthew, any other comments? Yeah, I'd just like to reinforce what Grace was saying. I had the pleasure of spending a year on the Hill, and it's really interesting the balance that is needed between the individual stories that are able to catalyze or exemplify a situation, but the absolute need to have the backup data to say how generalizable is this story, how many other people fall in this situation, and having the good methodological data behind those individual stories. Other questions for this panel, please.
My name is Arun Darpur. I am from Cornell University. This isn't a question, but it's just a comment that I would like to add for the first presentation regarding the transition aged youth and young adults and their health insurance related issues. Among the listed strategies that you mentioned as being we may want to explore if that works in covering more youth and young adults. One of the key pieces I would like to add is health transition and emphasis on benefits planning as these youth and young adults transition from being young adults to their adulthood. And another thing I would like to comment is the source of your data, the SIF. there's also a possibility that it is not capturing really those population of youth and adults who have actual disabilities as such, based on the type of definition they have within their database as far as disability is concerned. So exploring the similar type of analyses using different sources of data sets would be another step to reconfirm this notion that youth and young adults with non-severe disabilities are more likely not to have a health insurance as compared to their peers with severe disability classifications.
Grace, would you like to?
Yes, thank you very much for both of those comments. First, I can't agree more about the transition planning, and actually this is one piece of my dissertation, and the other components of it are also about transition. In other areas of my study, I've gotten a chance to talk with a handful of young adults who are going through that transition process, and from their own experiences and using their own narratives, that is one of the most important things as they become adults, is that they were more if their families and their health providers and their social support systems helped to prepare them and to increase their knowledge sort of earlier on in their teenage years and even their preteen years, the transition was much, much easier for them. So can't agree more. And as for the SIP, the SIP has is a wonderful data set. It's very rich, but it has huge limitations as well. I would love to be able to confirm findings in other data sets, and I'd love to hear more from you perhaps after. If you have any suggestions, the strength of the SIP is that it actually includes 15, it includes young people down to the age of 15. And so I'm actually able to capture some of those transition phases. Unfortunately, most data sets are either for adults over the age of 21 or sometimes 18, or they're exclusively for children. And so this transition time is really, it's a hole in research. So if you have ideas of other data sets, and particularly free data sets for poor students, I'd love to hear more about them. Thank you.
Other comments or questions?
This is for Dr. Is it Duggan or Dugan?
Dugan.
Dugan.
Spelled Duggan.
Thanks for your study, for your sharing today. I was struck by one of your reported statistics. 45% of the caregivers have delivered service for 11 or more years, I believe it was, something like that. And I'm not sure, you did talk later about formal versus non-formal. My hunch is a lot of those people in that group were probably more non-formal, more family type caregivers as
right.
opposed to, you know, hard
right.
care.
Right.
Where
possible, we found the primary caregiver was a family member, but there were three who did not have any family members that we did include in that study. So.
A real challenge, especially for rural areas. We heard earlier today from Mike Tracy that in rural areas, you really don't have sometimes a choice for others to do that. Just thinking about the policy implications, one of the big things this push is going on is this notion of unionization of PAS services around the country. Many of these individuals talked to both NICL, the National Council of Independent Living, in April about the notion of really trying to push the recognition, I guess, of the services the PAS folks do offer, pushing vacation, all these other things that you might consider as more professionalized service. Do you have any thoughts on that in terms of your findings, research, or guidance?
Well, okay, yeah, let's go for this one. But I am simultaneously involved in three different caregiver grants, okay? And the one that I'm working on now is taking a look at the landscape of caregiving, and we're taking a look at family members who are unpaid for their caregiving services on the one spectrum, and then on the other hand, home health agency employees on the other. And the middle one is those independent contractors who may or may not be family members, but who are paid through various waiver programs or whatever. And I don't know what to tell you right now, we're just in the middle of looking at that, but what was striking to us was that, well, maybe not, in terms of stress, stress levels are really high for unpaid family members, extremely high. And the least stresses are those that are provided by health agency employees. And you can see why. You know, there's just a limited time that they're there. They don't haven't seen these people for very long. And their major stressors have to do with income. They don't have the money. And in Detroit, you have to drive everywhere, and they can't afford the gas now to do these jobs. And they're in and out all the time. This is a terrible problem in the sense that there's such a stress anxiety level for the care recipient because they never know from day to day who's going to be their caregiver because, you know, parents die and they're trying to get what they can together. But I wish I could give you some idea. We are looking at this whole landscape of caregiving. Maybe would you pass the question again and maybe I'll try to answer better? Or?
I think I may, given where you are in your research, maybe
yeah.
It's not answerable.
One thing they do want is they people would like to have vacation pay family members who are compensated because they can't afford to pay other people to do it. But on the other hand, they're scared to employ respite care. They don't trust them. And so even if they had the time away, they're not going to take it because they are going to be more worried about that care recipient in the hands of somebody. So they would like to have family members, but they can't afford to. I mean, they're poor to begin with, mainly.
Hi, this is Kiyoshi Yamaki from the University of Illinois Chicago. I have a question to Matthew. I am very impressed with your analysis of the media. I just want to, if you can elaborate about the readership of the newspapers you selected, because it is my understanding that each of the newspaper may have specific target audiences so that the research or rehabilitative spinal cord injury articles they include in their own newspaper may be targeted to specific audience, not necessarily mass, you know, general public. So if you can give us a little bit of idea, who are the leadership of the newspapers that you used as a data source?
Yeah, we tried to select newspapers that were clearly national in their target audience and not representing maybe perhaps one, you know, a very specific constituency. So we went after the national newspapers that had the largest distribution rates. But we were very limited. For example, the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times are not included because LexisNexis does not include them. So we were already a bit constrained by who we can access. So the New York Times and the Washington Post and US Today, I think, are kind of your generic national newspapers. Then we have the Wall Street Journal, which LexisNexis limits you to abstracts of their articles only. But the Wall Street Journal does speak perhaps more to a more conservative constituency in general. So we actually kept them in order to include that voice. And also then the New York Post, which isn't in the top five distribution lists, it fell further down. But again, because the LA Times wasn't included, Chicago Tribune was out, we were left with them. But in a sense, I think the New York Post also speaks to balances the New York Times in being a little more conservative. So. But we see that kind of as an asset, as including them, to, you know, so that you have a little bit more balance in your five newspapers. But again, our hands were a bit tied with the LexisNexis application.
Thank you.